Welcome to our deep dive today. We're going to be talking about Dr. Leslie Allen's lectures on Ezekiel, specifically chapters 20 through 23. Buckle up. Prophecies of fire swords, shocking metaphors. Ezekiel does not hold back.
Yeah, no kidding. One of the first things that really struck me was how Dr. Allen highlights the structure of the Hebrew Bible in these chapters, especially compared to the English one.
Oh, how so?
Well, he argues that the Hebrew chapter breaks actually make a lot more sense, especially when you get to what the English Bible labels as Ezekiel 20.45.
Okay, I see. But why does that matter? I mean, it's just a chapter number, right?
Right, but it's not just a number. It's more about the flow of ideas. Like, the Hebrew chapter actually starts with that verse. And the whole reason for that is because of one word, sword. It pops up again and again and again. It's like the signal that there's a shift happening to this theme of destruction.
Oh, wow. It's like a siren, like a warning, you know?
Exactly. And it kind of links back to the imagery in the previous chapter, too, the one about the forest fire.
Uh-huh.
Both the fire and the sword represent God's punishment for Jerusalem's sin.
Right, right.
But the sword, though, it feels so much more direct, more visceral, like a military attack is about to happen.
Yeah, it's getting real. And you know, Wes, is interesting. Dr. Allen talks about how Ezekiel himself is instructed to do some pretty dramatic things to deliver these prophecies, like moaning, striking his thigh. It's intense.
Oh, it's totally intense. It's as if God's saying, like, listen, this is how seriously you need to take this message. It's showing how people should be reacting to the coming doom. And remember, Ezekiel himself was actually hesitant at first, you know?
Oh, really?
He thought the prophecies were a little too allegorical.
I see. So God's like, all right, here's something a little more concrete for you.
Yeah, exactly. And so we get this image of the source, but then it gets even weirder.
Oh, no. What happens?
Well, Dr. Allen explains that the sword isn't just some tool. It's almost like it has a life of its own.
Whoa. Okay.
It's described as being sharpened, polished, ready for slaughter. But here's the really shocking part. The sword's enemies are God's own people. The princes, the people of Israel. It's this unstoppable force of judgment. And it's turned on the very people it's supposed to protect.
Wow. So God's people actually become the enemy. That's a lot to unpack. What could even lead to that?
I know, right? And to really drive this point home, Ezekiel's actions get even more intense. Like, he cries, he wails, strikes his thigh again, and then he claps his hands. It's almost like he's giving the signal for the sword to begin its work.
Ooh, that's chilling. But then we're introduced to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and it seems like he's got quite a dilemma on his hands.
Oh, yeah. Nebuchadnezzar's got a big decision to make. Attack Ammon or Judah first, and get this, he uses divination to decide.
Really?
Yeah. He consults these idols called teraphim.
Teraphim?
Yeah, they were these little idols or household gods. People used them for divination in the ancient Near East. Think of them like a mystical eight ball. But anyway, he consults the teraphim, inspects animal livers, casts lots, the whole nine yards.
Wow. You know, I can only imagine what the Judean captives must have felt seeing all this go down. It's like their fate is being decided by these pagan rituals.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, talk about unsettling. But Dr. Allen points out that it's still God's judgment at work here, even with the method Nebuchadnezzar uses. Ultimately, the lot falls on Jerusalem. Foreshadowing, you know.
Foreshadowing.
Like the siege, Zedekiah's downfall, the whole thing.
Oh, right, right. So even though there are these, you know, pagan practices happening, God's will is still being done. It's almost a contradiction, isn't it?
It's definitely a tension that makes these prophecies so captivating. But hold on, because then in Ezekiel 21:28-32, we get another twist. The sword is suddenly ordered back to its sheath.
What? Why? What's going on?
Its work, at least for now, is done. Dr. Allen calls this the double program of God's judgment. See, Babylon was used to punish Judah, but Babylon itself is going to face judgment too.
Whoa, okay.
He even connects it to a passage in Isaiah 10 about how empires are used by God, but they're still held accountable. It's like this cosmic balancing act.
No one escapes justice, huh? Not even the empires. It really makes you think, are there Babylons in our own lives?
That's a good question. And here's another thing. This is actually the only time Babylon's fate is mentioned in Ezekiel.
Oh, right. So it just leaves us hanging.
It adds a whole other layer of mystery, doesn't it? But for now, the focus shifts back to Jerusalem, specifically the reasons behind its impending boom.
Oh, boy. What did they do now?
Well, in chapter 22, the key word is blood. Jerusalem is labeled the city of bloodshed.
Okay.
The accusations are heavy, shedding innocent bloods, idolatry,
uh-huh.
Major offenses back then. And the consequences are just as bad. Disgrace, mockery, even a loss of reputation for God himself. It's not just about individual actions anymore. It's like their sin has this collective impact.
So it's like a stain on the entire community, even affecting God's standing.
Exactly. And Dr. Allen even connects this back to Isaiah. There's this line, your silver has become dross. Think of dross like impurities in metal.
Like when you melt silver, and all the gunk rises to the top.
That's it. And Ezekiel actually builds on that image with this whole thing about a silversmith. He compares the people of Judah to silver ore being thrown into a furnace.
Oh, wow.
It's a symbol of God's judgment, obviously. And the question becomes, is this fire going to totally destroy them, or is it going to refine them?
That's a great question, because we tend to think about God's judgment as just purely, you know, punishment. But maybe sometimes it's also about purification.
Yeah, exactly. And that leads us to chapter 23, where we're hit with one of the most shocking metaphors in the book.
Let me guess. It's going to be a weird one.
Oh, you have no idea. God has two wives.
Two wives.
Two wives, Ahala and Oholibah. They represent Samaria and Jerusalem, but they're portrayed as God's unfaithful spouses. It's pretty wild.
That's a creative way to put it. But is this really about, like, romantic infidelity?
Not exactly. It's more about political alliances.
Oh, I see. So it's like they're putting their trust in other nations instead of in God.
That's it. And other prophets actually condemned these kinds of alliances, too, calling it a form of unfaithfulness.
Makes sense. So this wasn't just some, you know, abstract concept. This was a real issue they were dealing with back then.
Oh, totally. Especially Judah with their reliance on Egypt and the consequences. Well, let's just say God's not too happy. He warns that he'll turn their lovers against them.
So the very nations they relied on will be the ones to destroy them. That's rough.
And then we even get that cup of judgment metaphor again. Remember that one?
I think so. Refresh my memory.
It's an image that pops up throughout scripture, right? Represents God's wrath and judgment, all that fun stuff. But in this chapter, it's not just political unfaithfulness. There's religious unfaithfulness, too. And things get really, really serious when they start accusing them of child sacrifice. Yeah, it goes downhill from there. The consequences are pretty dire. Death for the sisters, their families, their homes. It's a stark reminder of the price of unfaithfulness, both politically and religiously.
No kidding.
And then there's this final message, and you all know that I am the Lord. Talk about leaving no room for doubt. It's like this final stamp of God's authority and the severity of his judgment. It's a lot to take in. What stands out to you the most so far?
Well, for me, I think it's just how vivid and, frankly, unsettling the imagery is. Like, you know, the sword having a life of its own, God having two wives. It's definitely not subtle, that's for sure.
It certainly grabs your attention, but I think that's what makes studying these ancient texts so valuable. They challenge us to think critically about our own beliefs and actions. How do we navigate a world that, in a lot of ways, is still struggling with these same issues of faith, power, and justice? It's something to think about, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's definitely given me a lot to ponder. We left off with God's judgment looming over Jerusalem, and man, that image of the two unfaithful wives, it's hard to shake. But it sounds like things get even more intense as Dr. Allen takes us into chapter 24.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Dr. Allen actually calls this chapter Ezekiel's watershed moment. Like, this is where prophecy collides with personal tragedy.
Oh, how so?
Well, imagine this. You receive a message about the imminent destruction of Jerusalem, okay?
Okay.
It's all symbolized by a boiling pot, right?
Oh, boy.
But get this. You get this message on the very same day your wife dies.
Oh, wow. That's just heartbreaking, experiencing that kind of loss while delivering such a heavy prophecy and even function.
I know. And to make things even tougher, God tells Ezekiel that he can't mourn his wife publicly.
He can't mourn her.
Nope. It's actually this really unusual command, and it's meant to be a symbolic act.
Symbolic. How so?
Well, it mirrors how the Israelites won't be able to mourn the loss of Jerusalem. Because their sins are so great, their hearts will be too hardened to even grieve properly.
So Ezekiel's personal grief becomes this, like, prophetic parallel, foreshadowing the nation's grief.
That's exactly it. And it's such a powerful way to show just how huge this coming destruction is. Ezekiel's silence speaks volumes, you know?
Yeah, I see that. But you know what's interesting? Dr. Allen mentions that there's actually some debate about whether Ezekiel's wife actually died. Like, was it a real death or just a symbolic vision?
Oh, yeah. It's one of those details that scholars go back and forth on.
It seems like a pretty important detail.
Right. Some scholars argue that the language doesn't necessarily confirm an actual death. Like, it could have been a visionary experience, you know, just to really drive home the prophetic message.
Okay. Yeah, I get that.
But Dr. Allen, he seems to lean towards a more literal interpretation. He says that the emotional weight of the passage suggests that this was a real life tragedy.
I mean, I can see both sides, but honestly, literal or symbolic, the impact is undeniable. It adds another layer to Ezekiel's role as a prophet, right? It's like his personal pain is tied to the feet of the nation. Makes him more relatable, I think.
Totally. We see him not just as this mouthpiece for God, but also as a person wrestling with grief and the weight of this huge calling. So yeah, it definitely humanizes him. But let's go back to that boiling pot for a second. What do you make of that imagery?
It's so vivid. The pot, the meat, the fire raging underneath. It's not subtle at all, is it?
Not even a little bit. It's like in your face, the pot is Jerusalem, the people are in it, and the fire, that's the intensity of God's judgment. And it's not just simmering, it's a full-on rolling boil.
And then there are those super graphic details about the meat cooking, the scum rising to the surface, the bones being scorched. It's a pretty disturbing picture.
It's not meant to be pretty. It's supposed to be unsettling to show that this isn't going to be some clean or painless process. And actually, Dr. Allen connects this imagery back to the silversmith metaphor in chapter 22.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that one? Both involved intense heat, purification, but the outcomes are different. What were they again?
Okay, so the silversmith metaphor was all about the smelting process. The intense heat purified the silver, right? But with the boiling pot, it's total destruction. Like there's nothing left but scorched remains.
You got it. It's like this progression of judgment, moving from purification to complete and utter devastation. It really makes you wonder, is God's judgment always about destruction? Or can it sometimes be about refining, even if it's a really painful process?
That's a really good question. And it seems like as these prophecies unfold, the stakes are getting higher and the imagery is getting, well, more intense.
And with chapter 24, there's a real sense of finality. Once the pot has boiled dry, even the pot itself gets consumed by the fire.
So there's nothing left?
Nothing. It symbolizes the total and utter destruction of Jerusalem. It's the culmination of all the warnings, all the prophecies that came before. Time's up, basically.
Wow, that's heavy. There's no coming back from that. But, you know, Dr. Allen points out a glimmer of hope in all this.
Oh, yeah, what's that?
Well, towards the end of the chapter, God tells Ezekiel that when the city falls, he'll be able to speak to the exiles again. Like his voice, silenced by grief, will be restored.
It's a promise of future communication, right? A hint that God's not done with his people yet. Even amidst all this judgment, there's a seed of hope planted.
And that brings us to the end of part two, folks. But don't worry, we'll be back in part three to unpack even more of Ezekiel's prophecies. All right, so we've journeyed through some pretty intense prophecies with Ezekiel, haven't we? Destruction of Jerusalem, his own personal tragedy. But now Dr. Allen leads us into a new section, starting with chapter 25, where it seems like Ezekiel's attention kind of shifts away from Judah and toward all the surrounding nations. What's going on there?
It's like the spotlight is suddenly on all of Judah's neighbors.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, chapters 25 through 32, they're full of oracles against seven specific nations. Ammon, Moab, Edom, Philistia, Tyre, Sidon, oh, and Egypt.
Whoa, that's quite a list. So after focusing on Judah's sin for so long, now it's like their turn to be in the hot seat? Is it like a you're not alone and facing consequences kind of message?
Well, Dr. Allen suggests there are actually a couple of layers to these oracles.
Uh-huh.
One layer is to show that God's justice isn't limited to just Israel. You know, he holds all nations accountable, not just his chosen people. It's about like establishing this universal standard of righteousness, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely broadens the scope. We're not just talking about one nation's story anymore. But you know what else I was thinking about? Those Judean exiles who are hearing these prophecies, wouldn't it be comforting for them to know that their enemies aren't just getting off scot-free?
Oh, absolutely. It's this big reminder that God's still in control, even while they're going through all this suffering. To see their enemies facing judgment, that would have offered them a kind of vindication, like God's going to set things right eventually.
Right. It's that cosmic balancing act. Again, Judah's being punished, but their enemies aren't escaping either. But I've also a warning in these oracles too, right?
Yeah, there is. God isn't just about punishment. By pronouncing judgment, he's actually giving these nations a chance to, you know, repent, to turn away from their wickedness.
So even in all this, there's still this element of grace, this possibility for change.
For sure. God's judgment isn't random. It's always rooted in this desire for people to come back to him. But let's get into some of the specifics here. Each oracle, it's really tailored to the sins and the history of that nation.
So it's not like this one-size-fits-all judgment.
No way. Like, Ammon is condemned for gloating over Jerusalem's destruction. No compassion there, right?
Yikes.
Then you have Moab, judged for being super prideful and arrogant. Each nation has to answer for its own mess, basically.
And knowing Ezekiel, I bet he doesn't just, you know, give some dry pronouncements of guilt.
Oh, you know Ezekiel. Always got to have those vivid metaphors.
Right. What's he got this time?
Well, Tyre, for example, they were this powerful maritime city. Ezekiel compares them to a magnificent ship that's going to get completely wrecked and sunk.
Oh, wow.
And Egypt, the ones Judah always ran to for help, they're likened to this mighty cedar tree that's going to be chopped down. Can you imagine the impact of those images on the people hearing this?
It would be hard to forget, that's for sure. But it seems like Egypt gets a lot of attention, doesn't it? chapters 29 through 32 are all about them.
It's because Egypt played such a huge role in Judah's history. Sometimes an ally, sometimes an enemy. Remember those political alliances we talked about?
Oh, right. Judah just loved turning to Egypt for support.
Even though God was like, don't do it. So yeah, these pronouncements against Egypt, they're like this final severing of those ties, this big wake-up call that Judah's hope should be in God alone.
Powerful stuff. And the imagery for Egypt is pretty intense too, right?
Oh yeah, they were once this powerful empire, right? But Ezekiel describes them becoming this desolate wasteland full of wild animals, total humiliation.
It really drives home that point that no nation, no matter how great, can escape God's judgment.
It's a sobering thought, for sure. But Dr. Allen makes a really important point here. These oracles against the nations, they aren't just about doom and gloom. They're actually a bridge between the pronouncements of judgment and the promises of restoration that come later in Ezekiel.
Oh, so they're like a necessary step towards a new era.
Exactly. These judgments, they pave the way for God's justice and righteousness to prevail. They make it possible for his people to be restored to their rightful place. Even in the darkest times, God's working towards something bigger.
That's an encouraging thought. Well, we've definitely covered a lot of ground in our Ezekiel deep dive. Ooh. From the fiery destruction of Jerusalem to the judgment of all those surrounding nations, it's been quite a journey. But what would you say is the key takeaway for us today? What can we learn from all these ancient prophecies?
For me, I think Ezekiel reminds us that God is a God of justice and righteousness. Yes, but he's also a God of mercy and grace. He holds everyone accountable, but he's always willing to forgive those who turn back to him. It's a message that's both challenging and hopeful, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. It challenges us to examine our own lives to see where we might be putting our trust in things other than God. And it reminds us to seek his guidance, to remember that his plan, even in the midst of judgment, is ultimately one of restoration and renewal.
Yeah, and that's definitely a message worth holding on to, no matter what we face in our own lives.
Couldn't have said it better myself. We've only just scratched the surface of Ezekiel's prophecies here today, folks. There's so much more to explore, so we encourage you to keep digging into this amazing book, grapple with those challenging messages, and discover the hope that's woven throughout its pages. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.